Hey everyone, it's Zach. Remember to tune in to The Last Dance, the behind-the-scenes look at the Chicago Bulls dynasty of the 90s. The series continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby, two of my buddies, immediately following the broadcast, which is presented, of course, by State Farm and brought to you by AT&T. You can find Jalen and Jacoby wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where we are in full Last Dance mode, because there is really not many other modes to be engaging right now. And I am so excited to be joined for the very first time on this podcast by one of the all-time greats. There's no other way to say it. One of the legends of the business and someone who is intimately familiar with the subject matter of The Last Dance, the great Michael Wilbon. How are you?
I'm good. My God, I got to do something to justify that introduction now. Jeez.
That's why I introduce people nicely, to put pressure on them. That's the only reason I do it.
It's good to meet you, man.
So you wrote a column right before The Last Dance started saying, essentially, be prepared to see another side of Michael Jordan in this documentary. So you've seen the whole – have you seen the whole thing?
No, I haven't. I purposely have not watched the whole thing. I wanted to see it in real time. I wanted to watch it like an old man watches television. I don't download. I don't do any of that stuff. I like watching with my 12-year-old son. Even he's like, Dad, don't you have the whole advanced thing? Isn't it right there on your laptop? Yes. And I just slam it shut on his fingers. And I'm like, no, we're going to watch this on television. Like it's 1969. And so that's what we're doing. And I kind of get a little preview of what's coming, but I haven't consumed the whole thing, Zach.
I talked to a bunch of the players for a feature I wrote on Kukoc today, and most of them are doing the same thing. They all have it, and they want to watch it with their families in real time. They want to be surprised. And it was funny. After the first two episodes, everyone was like, I need the next eight. I said, just be patient. We don't have a lot to look forward to right now.
Our Sundays need to have something. They need to hold some intrigue.
So in reading that column, it seemed what you were saying is, be prepared to like, you are one of the few people who, I think, when he gave the Hall of Fame speech, your reaction was like, what'd you guys expect? This is Michael Jordan. And it's like, you expected what? Some touchy-feely, hugging speech? You know, this is Michael. And I think your point in writing the column for The Undefeated was, be prepared because we're going to see more of that guy. You're going to see, you know, he's going to swear. He's going to be the – but I wonder – my takeaway has been – I feel like I'm seeing a brand new side of him that I've never seen before. You're seeing the ruthless competitor, but I'm seeing little glints in his eyes and little cadences to his voice where I feel like for the first time, I'm seeing what Michael Jordan sounds like at a bar with his friends. Now, you have been in that bar. Am I seeing that?
Yeah. Yes, you are seeing that. And that's what I wanted to see publicly. I've seen it. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I know all the stories. I said to him last week, I can't wait to see the stories I don't know. And he just goes, you know all the stories. What are you talking about? I'm like, no, I know I don't know all the stories because I don't, because he's a great storyteller. That's another thing that people don't know. Because Michael, he's not LeBron. He's not out there tweeting and on Instagram and that's not who he is. He's the opposite of that, even though he's not an introvert. So you have a real interesting dynamic. Here's a guy who's an extrovert, but he doesn't want to engage like that. He likes personal engagement. And so if you've been around and to get that personal engagement, Zach, you got to have been around, you know, like, so the people that folks are coming to, like me and Jackie McMullen, and I mean, we've been around Michael for decades. And at first, he probably didn't want to be around us either. But like anything else, you're a shoot around. There were many more opportunities then, right? So you're a shoot around, you're pregame, you're postgame, you're off days, you run into each other at restaurants. And pretty soon, you're more comfortable talking to those people than you are some of your new teammates who you don't know. And this is what people couldn't get used to with Kobe either. You'd hear players say, well, I never knew that. Because they didn't talk to people just because they were players. Neither does Mike. He, you know, you had to be around for a lot of this. And so I ain't going to pretend to know everything, but I know the guy that people are seeing, they're going, just see what your reaction is, which is, wow. Like, so I knew the Dennis Rodman, Carmen Electra, Vegas story. I knew that. I knew I've known it for 12 years.
There are so many Rodman stories that I don't even know what was in the public domain and what wasn't. Like when she was telling that story, I was like, I assume that was all out there because it's Dennis Rodman, but I guess it wasn't.
It wasn't because it was one of those things that I know off the record to me is serious. Off the record means off the record. And so now that it's been told, you know, you can get into stuff. And during this, when I sat for some of the interviews for The Last Dance, there were a couple of times where the director asked me, Jason asked me, okay, what about this? And I go, wait a minute. Is this now on the record? It's like there's stuff, and this is not just because it's Michael Jordan. This would be anybody that you know you have these relationships with. So yeah, seeing him like this is great. Just you know, with a cigar and a glass or whatever that is, it's just sort of cool. I just like that because that's like if you were fortunate enough to sort of be behind the curtain, that's what you got.
So you wrote a column. I was Googling around some of your old Jordan columns.
God help me.
And you wrote a column that I think gets at this side of him that I had not seen before, which I hope you can tell people the story, about going to Chicago to write a story on the rising center, Alonzo Mourning, and Michael's reaction to that. Do you remember this column?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I don't remember the column. I remember the experience.
So you tell know, people about it because I loved it.
Well, you know, covering Georgetown basketball is what I did for the Washington Post for a long time. And it's what the Washington Post still does. And so I'm still working for the Washington Post at the time. And Alonzo's having a great rookie year. And he's scoring a lot more than anybody thought, right? People thought Alonzo Mourning was going to be early on a 10, 12-point guy. And he's going to struggle. He didn't struggle. He came out, you know, 20-some points a game. And my sports editor, of course, says, hey, you got to go write about Alonzo Mourning. It's fairly early. So I fly to Chicago because I'm looking at the schedule. He's going to be here. He's going to be here. I can go home to Chicago. I'll get a visit out of this. I'll go. I'll also ask Michael and Scotty about Alonzo Mourning. So I walk in the locker room before the game that night. The game is that night. I walk in the locker room, the usual media period. And I'm talking to Michael. He goes, what are you doing out here this early? And I go, I didn't answer the question directly because I knew it might be coming. I made up something. I was coming home to see my family. Okay. So I start asking him about a lot of stuff, but then zeroing in on Mourning. And he pauses and he says, wait a minute. You fly to your home, my home now, to write about a blankety-blank Georgetown blankety-blank? Really? Did you do that? You flew here to walk in here to ask me about a Georgetown blankety-blank? And it was just, I mean, Michael has had such, you know, look at this first great shot of his life that we know about was in the national championship game against Georgetown. He and Patrick Ewing have this rivalry for years, Knicks Bulls. It's still Georgetown to him. And I was like, uh-oh. So Michael then continues and just said, what are you going to write if he scores no points tonight? Because I've been asking him about Alonzo scoring, right? And what are you going to write then? What are you going to put in the Washington Post tomorrow? If he goes no points. And I just said something like, you know, at that point, you're on the defensive. And you go, come on, what do you mean no points? And he gets, you know, he it's like he's looking at Joe Dumars. And he's like, you know what I said? You heard what I just said? No points. Blankety blank.
And Alonzo had a bad game. You wrote Alonzo.
He had three points when he went out, when he fouled out. But you have to get, people have to understand the full Michael Jordan thing. Like that. He probably needed something that night to get up for some rookie and get up for Charlotte, like in a game in, you know, December. I mean, Alonzo has 3 points and he fouls out. When Jordan checked out, he had 3 points. He might have had 12. I don't know, but it didn't matter. When Jordan was in
the game, he had no points. It's a bad game.
And Jordan went down and doubled down on him and took his left hand away and he did specific stuff. And you're like, oh my God, he did everything he told me before the game. So. You know, he said afterward, don't ask me about this in public. Come back and we'll talk about Alonzo. And when I get back there, this is Michael Jordan. He says, hey, don't be hard on this kid. He's going to be a great, great player. He's going to be a great two-way player. And he starts talking all these great things about Alonzo Mourning that I, of course, write about in the Washington Post the next day. That's who he is.
Where do you think the hostility between Michael and Isaiah Thomas, which was a lot of the subject of the Last Dance episodes from last night, where do you think that started? Did it start at the All-Star game in 1985 and the alleged freeze-out? Does it predate that, or is that a footnote and it really kicked up in the Bad Boys stuff?
I think This is just my interpretation. I think it might have been wariness in that early 85. Remember Magic, Bird, he, like, all of them were sort of held responsible, right? He wasn't even playing with Magic. He's playing with Bird and Isaiah. I don't remember hostility until they start playing each other. I mean, whatever it was in the mid-80s, Zach, that to me is incidental. Footnote is a good word. I'm not saying it wasn't there. I don't know. Maybe one of those guys would say, no, I hated them before. I don't remember it until those playoff series. Ooh.
Yeah, those are ugly. That's what playoff basketball is supposed to be. That's four years in a row.
Yes, it's so sanitized now. It's so sanitized. I mean, I remember when going to those games, man, the Celtics-Pistons. I mean, Bulls-Pistons was just an appetizer for Celtics-Pistons. People think folks in Chicago hate Villain Beer. People in Boston had graduate degrees in hating Lambeer by the time the Bulls got to him. So, and Laker fans too. So, I think my sense of it started during the playoff series.
What's the Michael game that you were at that is, if they took everything away from you, every experience away from you, wiped it out of your brain, that's the game that you're going to ask to keep. It's that Michael Jordan game that you just have to remember until the rest of your brain is gone.
There's so many, but okay. So one of them is in New York, game 5, block, strip, block, block on Charles Smith.
Smith stuff.
They beat the Knicks. Block, strip, block, block. I mean, every Chicagoan knows that. Every Bulls fan knows that sequence. And that's it. I remember so much about it, including the aftermath. My brother's a banker, and he works in New York and Chicago, and he had season tickets to the Knicks then, at least the bank did. And I remember him waiting for me to write, and it was like 2 hours later. I'm like, why are you still here? We got in the taxi. We're going up. I don't know. What goes up? 9th? 8th? I don't know. Whatever goes uptown.
One of the West Side Avenues.
We're on the West Side. We're going up. And I remember him just sticking out his head out of the window and just all of a sudden letting go and just a, the Knicks, the Knicks. And he's screaming out of the taxi window. And I'm laughing because I understand the sentiment. You know, the second city, that ain't no fun stuff forever and ever and ever and ever.
No, no.
And the Mets in 69 and all this crap you got to live with. And I love Patrick. I covered Patrick. He is a friend, a dear friend. I love him. And so many guys who have been on those Knicks teams, on that team. But that game, and I don't remember Michael's numbers. I think I do remember the numbers where he took Starks, Vanderway, Oakley twice, and then flushed on Ewing. I think he had a triple-double in that game. And I can't separate all the Knicks games in Madison Square Garden anymore. So it's like one experience, you know what I mean? So there's that. And then I cut my honeymoon short to come back to the Bullets series in 1997, the one where Jordan has 54. Calvert-Chaney blocks. He was like 22 of 35, right? Okay, seriously, how insane a percentage is that?
You look at his stat lines in some of these games, and it's like, is my computer broken? Like, what happened?
Right. Well, Calvert-Chaney got a hand on Michael's shot 4 times. He blocked 4. He had his hand on. And sometimes Michael would reconfigure, right?
Yeah, in there.
And he'd get the shot. So anyway, after the game, I remember asking, look, I don't want to sound stupid. Just jump me if you have to. I know what you just scored. I know what you just shot. But that seems like it's one of the great defensive efforts I have ever seen you go against. And without hesitation, Michael just said, yep, you're absolutely right. He goes, nobody's going to believe you because of the numbers. I remember that because the game was, again, I cut my honeymoon short to come back to cover that series. I was writing the column for the Washington Post. I wasn't going to miss Jordan against the Bullets.
No.
And Calvert-Chaney. Calvert-Chaney's going to like Calvert-Chaney. If you look at the numbers, it looks like Calvert-Chaney got torched. He was living in Jordan's jersey the whole game. That's how great he was in that game.
So the Smith-stuffed game, to me is one of the most consequential games of the last 25 years in the NBA. And because the Bulls lose the first two games of that series and then win the next four. Yeah. And that's the one where you just know once they get that game in New York, there's no chance the Knicks are coming back to Chicago and getting game six. So I wonder, it's actually relevant now as I'm thinking about it, because the Knicks were kind of the next bad boys. They were the team that took the mantle of the bad boys. So did, and they were really, I mean, to go up 2-0 on a Jordan team, I don't think, did anyone else go up 2-0?
Nobody else had done that.
Except Cleveland in 89, you know, right, yeah, just, once they started winning. No,
remember, so, they only won one by, well, no, they won two. They won 91 and 92 because that was 92. Yeah.
So two questions. Number one, I don't know if there's something you remember from the aftermath of that game other than your brother taunting everybody in Manhattan. And B, do you think that, what was your read on, like, did Michael respect those teams as much as he did the Pistons, or did he feel a similar sort of like they're playing dirty basketball like the Pistons did?
Yeah, I remember the phrase "dirtying up the game." The hatred for the Knicks was nowhere near the hatred for just the Pistons. My feeling of it, because no matter how much you can hate the Knicks symbolically or institutionally, he has too much respect for Pat Riley early on, and I know Pat only coached one of those Knicks teams, right? He beat four Knicks coaches, I think. I think he beat Riles, he beat Van Gundy, he beat, like, I don't know, who else did he beat? He beat Patino.
Yeah.
And he beat somebody else. I don't think he beat Don Nelson. I don't think Don Nelson lasted long. I think he beat four Knicks coaches. But he had too much respect for them, and it wasn't as personal as it was the Pistons. And the Pistons, the Knicks didn't have a guy like Lame Beer. I can't overestimate to you how loathsome Lame Beer was. I can't. I mean, there's nobody on the Knicks who was that guy, who was like a target. It wasn't, because Oakley, come on, Oakley had been, Riley had to issue an edict to not, you know, fraternize with Jordan. So how bad could it be? It just wasn't. It wasn't as bad, but man, they had a chance to beat them. And the Knicks, when the Knicks couldn't beat the Bulls in game five, and look, they got outplayed by Scotty the next year in game five. They got outplayed. And they couldn't beat the Bulls. I don't care what the series said. The Bulls outplayed them. And they couldn't get through it. And I thought that was the one thing that didn't allow the Knicks to get all the way through to win. I feel bad for Patrick, actually, about some of that.
Well, I feel bad for a lot of guys who had the misfortune of playing during Jordan's time and didn't get rings. You mentioned Pippen. I'm curious. I told you about this. I went back and read a column of yours from 1994 after Pippen sits out the game that Kukoc ends up winning in the conference semifinals against the Knicks, where you said you would hear players – you weren't calling him this. You would hear players whisper, "Scottie Pippen is a punk." I'm wondering – I want to know more about that. How, like, you would really hear that? And B, you said your you said in an interview somewhere I read – your personal opinion of Pippen has evolved over time to the point that you think you were maybe too low on him during some points of his career.
I know I was. I've said to Scotty, and this goes back 15 years, maybe he was at the end in Portland, or maybe he was back with the Bulls. And I just said, I'm sorry for some of the stuff I wrote. Nobody asked me to say it. I think Scotty just said, I think I know him well enough to know that these things did hurt him, and they were unnecessary, and they were wrong. They were wrong. I mean, who wants to be judged on their worst moment? Right? And again, if you only have that moment, okay. If all you've got is a game where you played badly against the Pistons and went 1-for-11, the migraine game.
Yeah.
And if you had this thing with Kukoc, if that's all you had, then you know what? Scotty's got – his resume is so enormous. It's so enormous. The Bulls won no championships without Scottie Pippen. He's not just a great Robin. He's a great player. The next year, he could have been the MVP.
He was in the conversation.
Was Akeem the MVP?
Akeem was the MVP. I believe Scottie, I want to say off the top of my head, Scottie finished third in the voting.
He was great. He was great. He was MVP, I think, of the All-Star game, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right about that. Yeah, I don't pay a lot.
He was so great. He was so great on the way up with Michael. He was so great to put up. And Jerry Krause is such a villain. I'm sorry. I know he's dead. He can't answer for himself. Jerry was a bad guy in that context. He was. When your owner says you were trying to short shrift the number two guy in the history of this franchise, You're a bad guy. And you can't tell the story of the Bulls in the Last Dance without saying Krause was a villain. You just can't. Not in my way of seeing it. And Scotty is too bad. He's just too great a player. He's the most underappreciated player of his time. Even now, even with all of this, I always think that Elgin Baylor is the most underappreciated player of all time.
That's a great name for that designation, by the way. And the further back we go, the further out we go in time, people are just not even, they're not going to know his name, let alone his impact on the game.
It's scary, Zach. And then Scotty was so good. Scotty was the point guard. He was the point guard, all those things. Like my son says, well, Dad, why do you always say that when Steve Kerr, John Paxson? I'm like, no. They were wing players. They were wing shooters. And they were great at what they did. And they might have to guard you, the point guard, but Scotty did that sometimes too, Magic Johnson. But
well, what you just said is important, because I was interviewing Bill Cartwright for a story the other day. And, you know, Jordan won a Defensive Player of the Year. Rodman's a two-time Defensive Player of the Year. Bill Cartwright, who's sort of the old sage on those early teams and then a coach for the later teams, the second three-peat teams, will tell you there's no question who the best defensive player on the team was, and it was Scotty. And he said, if you look back at our series, whatever the problem was, Phil's answer was throw Scotty at it. Just throw Scotty. Wherever it is, throw Scotty at it.
It's just like completely unappreciated. Scotty and Horace. I mean, Horace, the Dobermans did not involve Dennis Rodman. The Dobermans were Michael, Scotty, and Horace. And that was the first great defensive trio that.
And this is what Wennington and I were talking about. Then it became, how are you going to score when Harper, Jordan, Pippen, and Rodman are four or five guys on the court? Fine. You go at Longley or you go at Kukoc. And the other four guys are going to be there helping and swiping at passing lanes. Like, what are you going to do?
Well, that's why when people start talking about the Warriors, well, the Warriors would kill the Bulls. Shut the F up.
Wow.
Who thinks that? The Warriors couldn't kill the Bulls. How could they?
Well, none of those teams are going to kill any of those other teams.
No.
That's
right.
The answer.
It's going to be competition. And so the first thing when I tell people to shut up is just stop. Nobody's going to kill Michael Jordan's team ever. Now, you got Jordan, Rodman, Pippen, Harper. You got they couldn't guard every position? People think guarding positions and switching. The Bulls didn't switch because they didn't have to. It wasn't played that way then. You got on your man and you stayed in his butt. Isaiah talks about that, by the way. Isaiah talks very eloquently, Isaiah Thomas, about that. Isaiah Lord Thomas.
not the current Thomas. Isaiah Thomas.
Our Isaiah. So but when you have those four guys out there, I'm sorry, who's going to guard them? Who's going to guard Michael and Scotty? I know Kevin Durant's a great defender. I know Klay Thompson's a great defender. So fine, it'd be a match. But don't tell me that the Bulls four couldn't guard anybody playing today. So when Isaiah says, they couldn't guard, you know, Cleveland or Miami, the hell they couldn't.
Well, I was watching I've been watching a little bit of the Pacers Bulls conference finals from the last dance season. And great. think about being Reggie Miller.
Yeah.
So Ron Harper starts on you because, you know, we don't want to get Michael tired. Let's have Ron Harper start. All right, Ron Harper's expended some energy. Michael, you take him for 5 minutes. And just in case Scotty can take it, think about being Reggie Miller. There's no break. It's just one after another of who's ever fresh is going to ruin your life.
His greatness, I'm afraid, is getting forgotten too. Reggie Miller. Reggie ran off. My God, he was like a pinball. And he still had the energy late in games in that game six to win that game with a jump shot in the playoffs. That team gets totally forgotten because you go Pistons, Knicks, Pacers. But the Pacers actually played the game once Michael became a champion, once Michael, Scotty, all the group. The Pacers were the threat. That game seven, they were ahead late in that game. And Reggie was magnificent. But, yeah, but those defensive teams the Bulls had, I said to Michael once, and I have believed this until last night, I think, when I really delved into it. I would say to Michael, the 92 team is greater than the 96 team. And he would say to me, have you lost your mind? And I would say, no, because Horace Grant is a better all-around basketball player than Dennis Rodman. Rodman shot 46% that year. He shot 53% from the line. He averaged 5 points a game. Horace was like 58%, 58, Horace Grant. He shot 74% from the line. He averaged 14 points, and he was a great defender who did not turn rebounding into a selfish statistic.
Horace Grant
was a great player for exactly what they were doing. I'm not saying he was Look, we know Rodman did one thing better than anybody else of his generation, which was grab the damn ball, and possession's everything. But anyway, I would say this to Michael, and now he would let me go on like I just did with you, and then he would just say, I'm going to throw you out of the locker room. I'm going to throw you out of it. So I stop. I do it when I want to annoy him.
The Low Post coverage of The Last Dance is brought to you by State Farm. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Coverage is also brought to you by AT&T. I have two questions that I have to ask you as someone who was there and who knows them, and then I will stop wasting your time. Number one, there's this – it's like I have to do a LexisNexis. People don't even know what that is. I have to do like a LexisNexis deep dive into this because there's this idea that comes up over and over again that until Michael won, it was a popular trope that Michael's not a winning player. He's a selfish scorer. And as a kid – so I'm 87, 88, 89. I'm like 10, 11, 12 years old. I have memories of like having that argument with my friends. I think, I'm not sure. Like you're in the media. How real was that? Like how widespread was that? Was it written? If I go back, will I find columns saying this?
Yes. You'll find a lot, all the old sports writers who are dead and gone. But some of the great, great sports writers of the day who were in – they had come along, some of them as early as Ruth and Joe Louis, and they were in their 70s and maybe 80 years old by then, and they would look at Jordan and just say, he's not Russell or Cousy, or if they wanted to update it some, they'd compare him to the 70s Knicks who shared the ball beautifully. And if they were a little bit younger, even in their 60s, they would say, he's not Bird and Magic. He can't be those guys. It's too selfish a style of play. He's never going to win this way. Being the big scorer is not going to work. And this was sort of, the director, Jason, put that to Michael in episode 4, I think. Yeah, it was a thing. It was a thing. And then there finally were people saying, he's going to do this. We don't care. I remember Tony Kornheiser was one of them. Tony was one of the people who said, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that. This guy's the greatest, and he thinks Magic is the greatest player of all time. Kornheiser still, that's his pecking mm-hmm. with Magic than Michael. But he would say, Michael Jordan's going to win because he's the best player. All this other stuff is garbage. It's old school crap. And I don't want to hear it. And he'd get into fights with, you know, Dick Schaff. And, you know, he'd get into fights with, you know, Dick Young. All these guys who covered baseball, boxing, everything in the world. And they thought that Jordan just, he didn't have that thing. And that's, you know, when you start getting into the triangle and Phil and Tex Winter. And why they fired Doug Collins. Look, I'm going to say this. I heard Stephen A. say that the Bulls would have won without Scotty, but not without Phil. I go the other way around. They would have won without Phil. Doug Collins and the Bulls would have won. Doug Collins, Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan, they would have won. It might have looked different. I don't know exactly. Their will was too great. Their skill was too great. Their talent level was too great. They loved Doug Collins. See, people like in the episode, they think that Michael got Doug Collins fired. Did you hear what he said about him? He loved him.
He loves Doug. He's still – well, there's a reason. There's a reason why he was the coach of the Washington Wizards when Michael was there.
Exactly. I would say to people, they'll say, why is Doug going to come and coach for him? Michael, hey, I'm like, stop. You know, all these old wives' tales. But the notion was out there that Jordan couldn't win unless he dramatically changed his game. And it's like, okay, I'm not buying that. But a lot of people bought it. They had to see it. They had to see him go through the Pistons and go through Magic in those consecutive series in 1991 to believe it.
I think the most likely reason he ended up winning was, I mean, like LeBron didn't win until his seventh or eighth year in the league. And like, I think the most likely reason, most boring reason, which is that the Bulls gained experience and got older and they entered their primes and some of the Pistons exited their primes. And so that's naturally what happens. And I actually agree with you. I think your scenario of they win with Collins is much more likely than Stephen A's scenario of they win without Scotty. I mean, who do you replace Scotty with in this scenario? I have no idea. The other question I have to ask you, because you may actually know the answer, why did he retire in 1993? What's your best guess?
Burnout.
You think it's just that simple? Just burned out, fame, winning, father's death?
Yes. So combine those things. Remember how he fell to the floor and was sobbing. And I just think, look, LeBron had something similar to that when he needed a little bit of time and was able to take care of it in a very little bit of time. Something I admire LeBron. He could just grind through that many trips to the finals. Unbelievable. And Michael, I have asked him, you know what? I don't know that I've ever said the words in that order, why did you retire? But I did say to him, it took me long enough. I just said this a couple years ago. I said, there's something I've never asked you, I got to ask you. If the Bulls had won or even gotten to the finals, the year they got jobbed in Madison Square Garden in game 5 on Scottie's jump shot, they called it a foul. The Bulls had won that on B.J. Armstrong's jump shot. If they win, then they'd have to beat Indiana in the conference finals. And you know, there ain't no guarantee of that, as great as Reggie Miller and the Davis boys were and Mark, all that. But if they had gotten to the finals without you, would you have come back and said, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Another one.
That was one of those you ask and you don't know what the answer is going to be.
Another one like that I wanted to put to you was, let's say they beat Utah in 98, which they do. Let's say after that, Jerry Krause says, you know what? I've made a mistake. Phil, 2 years, $25 million, come back and be the coach. Does Michael come back for sure? Is it like 100% chance he comes back?
100%. 100%. He has said any number of times within my earshot, you run it back. I wanted to play until somebody beat us.
What if Scottie left? What if Scottie was like,
I don't know they could have got anybody that, just like you said, who are you going to get to do all the stuff Scottie did? I mean, you think about the league at the time, a lot of great players, and it was set up a transitional time. It really was. I don't know. Maybe that would have been his challenge to try to win, because he's got cool coach at that point. He still got Ron Harper. You know, I guess you keep Steve Kerr. If you keep the band together except for Scottie, well, Scottie was a free agent, so they couldn't have traded him.
That's what I'm saying. If Scottie just says, I've had enough, Michael, I'm sorry, I've had enough for this, I got to leave.
I never asked him that specific. But I know that they thought, and you know, you and I have said to Scottie as he sat next to us as a colleague now, you know, you guys didn't want to break up. It's like, no, we wanted to play. We wanted to, so who can beat us? And to me, that's the spirit of competition, which in some ways doesn't exist now. We're missing that. Today's players don't want to hear it, but we're missing that because in some cases, there's a fear of failure that goes to public hubris. And what people are going to think and what they're going to say and what Instagram is going to and Twitter. And they didn't care about all that. The Bulls didn't care about all that.
Now, you sound, when you say things like that, like the guys who were saying, well, he's not Bill Russell, he's not Bob Cousy. But you hear players. J.J. Redick tweeted something like this recently. Other players have said, like, you hear present-day players say things like, I wish more of the guys on my team cared a little bit less about Instagram and a little bit more about kicking the shit out of the other team. Like, I don't think that notion of – I don't think what you're saying is just a complete generation gap. There may be some – there's definitely a social media thing that has taken over the NBA that is a little that some players within the league are like, Michael wouldn't have embraced this, or like so-and-so alpha competitor wouldn't have embraced
it now. He's not on any of it. He didn't do any of it. He didn't embrace it now. He just, yeah. And I think one of the underreported stories, Zach, is that we're in the biggest generation gap in the history of modern civilization. By modern, I mean, I don't know, let's go back to the end of the Civil War forward. We're the biggest generation gap ever because we fundamentally don't have the same values. We don't. I mean, I tell young sports writers, stop. Get off of goddamn Twitter and watch the game. You don't even know how to watch the game because you're tweeting. I go crazy about this stuff in live time. I walk up and down press row.
But don't you?
My son, put that away. Watch the game.
First of all, I 100% agree with you. I tell people all the time, my computer, I'm taking notes during the game. My Twitter is no. You will never see me tweet during a game unless it's a blowout or something extraordinary has happened. Jackie McMullen says, I'm her favorite person to sit next to at a game. Because I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to talk to her. I don't bother anyone. I'm just watching. She's like, I love sitting next to you. You don't bother me. But don't you think that's partly the fault of editors and media who are like, we need a story about shoot around. We need a notebook column. You need to start filing your story in the third quarter. You need like they can't watch the game. Too many people are not empowered to watch the game.
They don't understand the game. They don't know the game. They don't. The conversations that I have sometimes with older people or coaches, you know, they don't stick around. I probably shouldn't tell this story, but Jason Kidd, I was with Jason Kidd recently, and Jason came over. One of the last things I covered before this pandemic knocked it all out. And we had a big, you know, man hug and talked. And he said, hey, I want to hear some stories. And I said, don't sound like an old man, Jason. He goes, I'm an old man. I want to hear some stories. People come now. They just tweet. They just look at their numbers. They don't talk basketball the way we talked about it, the way I talked about it to you when we were both younger, 25 years ago. And I said, Jason, now you sound like a real old man. Of course, I believe every word he said. I believe every word Jason Kidd said. And so you now don't have people shoot around. You know what I use shoot around for? Shoot around was to just, that was FaceTime. And it was to get to know somebody. Like, I like all the people that folks called crazy, except Rodman. I didn't talk to Rodman. Rodman was just too out there. But other people that folks would say were crazy or they were mean or they were whatever, like people would say that about Kenyon Martin. I would go to shoot around just to talk to Kenyon Martin, who is one of my all-time favorite people to talk to. Or I'd go just to talk to Gary Payton when people thought Gary was tough to get to know. Gary wasn't tough to get to know. He's great. I would go to shoot around just to – there's no notebook, Zach.
No.
There's no stats. There's none of that crap. Learn who people are and listen to their stories. And there's none of that anymore. And
I think more people would like to do that, except every single publication in the world is like, well, you got to be the 50th person videotaping Steve Kerr's opening remarks because if we don't have it, it's, but like, I'm with you. I'm at shootarounds. I'm talking to the assistant coaches. I'm talking to that guy over there. I'm talking to that guy over there. And we're just, about nothing, just about something to watch in the game tonight. Or
about other sports, you learn what makes other people tick. I mean, I Ron Harper. You know, people talk about your favorite guys to talk to on the Bulls. My son asks me that all the time. And I'm like, Maddie, I'm grateful that I had the access to talk to Michael and Scottie and Phil Jackson and Steve Kerr, the people that are famous, truly famous, and he could get to who they are. And I'm like, you Ron Harper, I had to meet Ron Harper one day. And let's face it, Ron Harper is like encyclopedic in his knowledge about this stuff. You don't know that unless you give it a chance.
And by the way, talk about a guy who people don't realize how good he was before injuries got his knees and stuff. Whew, Ron Harper was a stud.
Yes, he was. And just knows the game. I mean, to me, like I'll sometimes ask Ronnie, why aren't you coaching like all the way up? And because Ron's on a golf course more than even Michael. But he was one of the people who's encyclopedic. And if you're not getting to know those kinds of people when you're covering a sport, what the hell? What the hell are you doing if you just tweet?
Golf brings me to my last question, and I'll let you go, because I asked you, have you ever golfed with Michael? Because that would be a bucket list experience for me, is to golf with Michael, although I do not make enough money to golf with Michael Jordan. But you
that
said
– how good you are.
You said, I'm, well, that's true. I wouldn't even get on the course with him. You said no, but you have a – I think you said you do have a story about Michael trash-talking you on a golf course. Please tell that – I have no idea where this is going. Tell that story.
I'm playing in the Bahamas in his tournament. I'm grateful to have been invited. And I have participated in several. In the Bahamas, I'm playing with Jerome Bettis on Sunday, and we're playing against Ken Griffey Jr. and Alonzo Mourning. And, you know, it's fun. It's competitive. I am the fourth person in that group in terms of skill level and all of that. I was probably an 11 handicap then. And we're playing on Sunday, and I'm standing over a putt, grinding over these putts, trying to win. And across, like out of a bunker, comes Michael, and he's saying he knows I can't make the putt. I'm not even playing against him. I'm playing against Griffey Jr. and Alonzo Mourning. And it was great. And I think one of the reasons I got access to Michael, I grew up on the south side of Chicago with a lot of people who talked a lot of trash. It was an art. It is an art. So people like Michael and hearing Larry Bird and all that stuff, Gary Payton. Gary Payton's one of my favorite players of all time. It's an art. And if you got it and you could laugh or you could smile even in the moment when it was being directed at you, they got a twinkle out of that. They knew you were okay. They knew you're all right. This guy gets it. He is not intimidated. He's laughing even though I'm coming at him. And that is what I loved about that moment. I mean, I wasn't playing pickup basketball. I used to play a lot of pickup basketball. I wasn't around the Bulls. I was around the Bullets for that stuff. Rick Mahorn, one of my favorite guys of all time, speaking of Pistons, Bad Boys. And you had to take that. That's an initiation. You can't take the trash talking. What are you doing out here? You're not really a part of sport, or maybe that's not a part of your culture. Part of mine. And so getting trash talked by NBA, I was laughing. I made the putt.
I was going to say, Jamaica? What's that?
I made the putt. I didn't make many that day. I kept missing right edge putts, which you know, caused for some laughter later. But yeah, so that's my only no. I'm grateful to have been invited and included in his tournaments, his charity tournaments. I'm grateful. I mean that.
And I bet
he didn't have to have that. It's just.
I bet Griffey was a scratch golfer, wasn't he?
The most unbelievable golf swing I've ever seen.
Of course,
a lot of golf is not authored by a golfer. It's Ken Griffey Jr.'s.
Griffey's a little bit Jordan-esque in that the minute you saw him jog, you were just like, oh, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. People don't move like that.
He's a great – his golf swing, it's the prettiest golf swing I've ever seen. Yeah. And, I've said that to him. He's like, stop. It isn't. I'm like, no, it actually is. And you wonder at it. So, yeah, so that's the only trash talk. I mean, there's other trash talking stuff. I mean – that's a great scene last night. I don't know who the journalist was, a columnist who ducked his head in the training room, and Jordan goes, you wrote a good column about me the other day. We're good. There'd be plenty of that trash talk.
Oh, I'm sure.
That was such crap you wrote this morning. And again, you know, if you could not have the give and take with that, like, seriously, you took yourself too seriously if you could.
Mike, you've given us way too much time. So you're going to write for The Undefeated the Monday after every episode? Is that airing?
I think. Zach, this is too hard. I don't do this anymore.
I always tell people writing hurts my brain.
God. I loved writing after events more than anything in my life. I was there for Holyfield having his ear part of it bitten
off,
rolling across the ring like a Tootsie Roll. And I wrote a column that night in about 40 minutes that I was proud of.
Wow.
It takes me 4 hours. So, yes, I'm going to do this, but when you don't do it every day, you lose it, and I may have lost it all.
Well, you wrote a great piece on Rodman and Michael's relationship today at The Undefeated, and so keep doing it. We want to hear it, and we want to – this is a landmark event, and you're a part of it. So I appreciate you making a little time. People can I feel ridiculous being like, people can watch him on PTI. Yeah, no we can watch you on PTI. Michael Wilbon, thank you for your time. Stay safe, stay well, and I hope to see you at an NBA arena at some point before 2021.
NBA arena, or at least a TV studio sitting next to you, just something.
Something. All right, thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.